Pray in Jesus' name. Thank you, young folks, for those good. We already had six little sermons here, so I don't know if we need another one or not, but thank you for sharing. Brother Tim said that you're changed, so are we. Ridgeview is a different place since you came back from Bible school, or it will be. It won't be the same. So these are the influences that are good for us. Welcome back, Brother Steve and Sister Judy and your family. Glad you made it safely back to this side of the globe. To write the love of God above, would drain the ocean dry, we sang. Thanks, Brother Aaron, for leading that song. It always transports me back to about 6 years old in first grade at school, singing that song out of some little paperback book or something, and marveling on that as a little boy who was like, you know, the bare little brain who was trying to think through these big ideas. Really, how could you fill the sky talking about God? But it's good. Turn in your purple songbooks to 889 a while. We'll get to that in a minute, but a few weeks ago, we looked at the power of Gelassenheit and defenselessness and how we follow Jesus' example of non-resistance to evil and how we conquer by yielding. And the twin doctrine to that, the idea of non-resistance, is what the New Testament writers called ecclesia, the separation of the church out of the world. And Brother Ashton nailed it right when he said that his teacher said that non-resistance doesn't make any sense apart from the concept of being called out of the world. And that's for sure. Peter says it, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people. That means a special possession. Why? That you should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And the title of the sermon this morning is Called Out of Darkness into Marvelous Light. And I would like to look at the other side of the discussion on Gelassenheit. How many of you have friends or close relatives, maybe relatives or friends, who in your memory have traded off a separated lifestyle for one that is more mainstream American culture? How many of you have friends or relatives like that? Okay, so one time they walked a separated way, and then they don't anymore. They gradually lose their will to be different. They gradually take on more of the world's entertainments, fashions, fun things, worldviews, ethics, and at first maybe they're quite loud in their testimonies of God's goodness in liberating them from these bondages, and then after a while maybe you've seen their testimonies get a little quieter as they find out that real liberty in the world's sense of individuality gets to be a pretty hard taskmaster, and things go worse for them in the long run. This happens, and it's hard, and we see that, and then it raises questions in our own minds. Well, why do we keep trying? Why do we keep trying? And sometimes we're reminded that the reason we keep trying is when we see shipwrecks and we see how bad they can be. Then we might know why. But it's unfortunate, I think, that too often the discussions about separation in our churches has been distracted by the endless tug of wars and the layers of custom that have been built in around things like appearance and the things that we might wear or do. And it's true, we're visually oriented, and one of the most obvious first things that people recognize about, say, the plain people is that they don't dress the way other people do. That's true. But I think sometimes in the wrangling over that, we kind of lose sight over the whole basic principle about why we should even care. What is the biblical defense even for being a called out people, about being on a different path? And we're going to sing this song that you have there. It's just a little chorus, the end of a longer song. Turn your eyes. Let's try to sing here.
Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. And the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory.
It's a response. It's a response to having been called out of darkness. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. I want you to turn to Hebrews 11 to start. In the Old Testament patriarchs, the men of God, were all called out to follow a different path. And we can go straight down the line in Hebrews 11 about these men. We have Noah, who God said, look, the earth is cursed. It's full of wickedness. I'm going to destroy it. You get out of it. Get into the boat. Save your family. And he does. And then after that, they build the Tower of Babel. God has to separate the people. And we find the man Abraham. And God, what does God first tell Abraham? He finds him in the land of Ur there, and he says, Abraham, get out of this country and from your family. I'm going to take you to a place that's not here where all the others are. And we've been reading about the patriarchs and some of the concerns they had about where their sons get wives. And they would say, I don't want you, son, to take a wife from these wicked people. I want you to go to a place where you can get a woman of God, and you have that line of being separate. So Joseph winds up in Egypt. We're talking about that right now. And eventually the brothers come down, and when the brothers come down in Egypt, God says, now we're going to have you live over here in Goshen, not among the Egyptians, because they're really ungodly people. And so here you have in Moses, the story of Moses, verse 25, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. So Moses says, by faith he forsook Egypt. He ran away from Egypt. And then God said, look, I have a job for you. I want you to go back and lead the children of Israel, your people, out of Egypt. And we're going to go to Canaan. I have a place for you. I'm calling them out of a place of darkness. And so they do, and on the way they have the law given to them, and God says, look, I'm going to have different ways for you to worship than the Canaanites around you. I'm going to have different ways for you to take care of the social needs among you. That's different than the way the Canaanites around you do. I'm going to have you wear certain things and do or don't do things that are different from the people around you. It was just part of the whole package, and I want you to see here especially verse 13 to 16. These were in Hebrews 11. These died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, in heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. And look in verse 15, it says right there, if their hearts had been set on the country they came out of, they could have gone back. And they sure tried, right? The Israelites said, we had watermelons in Egypt, can't we go back? And here we are in the desert. Can't we go back from where we've been delivered from? And you know, people still go back for the watermelons all the time. They're called out of the darkness, and it's a glorious deliverance. And at some point, this verse 15, they have opportunity to go back and go back into what they were delivered from. So this is still a real thing, but what I'm pointing out here is that through the Old Testament, you cannot read the Old Testament without realizing that it was God's design that, like Jesus said, we're in the world but not of it, that the idea of being separate from the surrounding culture was built in from the very beginning, from Abraham through the patriarchs, through the children of Israel, and right up until we see the man Jesus coming on the earth. And what's the first thing he does? He goes around the seasides and the villages and the marketplaces in Galilee and Nazareth, and he says to people, follow me. I want you to leave what you're doing and the way people around you are doing it and follow me. I'm going to set you apart for a different kind of work. And so that's the second point of the message here. We're called out of the crowd to follow a different leader. So let's read this in Matthew 7. Please turn to Matthew 7. Verse 13. Matthew 7, 13. Enter in at the straight or the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat, because straight is the gate and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. And so Jesus does not mince words. He comes to the earth and he says, I have a message of deliverance, but I have to tell you, not many people are going to find it. That's just the way it is. And so when people, it's unfortunate, and we want to lift the gospel to everybody, but for those who, for example, there was a time, not so much nowadays anymore, but it was maybe more of a theme around the 1910s and 1920s, when the idea caught a fever in the Christian religion, the Christian churches around the world, that we're going to have a worldwide revival, and all men around the earth will come to know Jesus if we would just be vigilant enough in our evangelism. And it's not true. Jesus said, no, a few people are going to find the little door, but most people are going to keep on going. And you know, that's a very basic starting point on this concept of separation, is that, yes, we want all people to hear the gospel, but those who follow Jesus will always be the few. You will not be popular. You will not be like most people. And so if I can't stand the stigma of being the oddball, I'm not going to be able to follow Jesus. That's just built into the very basic calling when Jesus says, come follow me. And so if I'm really self-conscious about the way people look at my truck and my clothes and my house and my landscaping and my everything else, if I'm really self-conscious about whether I fit in or not, I'm already thinking like a broad road. I'm thinking like I want to be with the masses. I want to be accepted by most people. That's the kind of mindset. And Jesus says, no, that's not going to work. If you want to follow me, you have to be willing to be a little different. And so that's how it is. If you find it tempting to go and buy the fashion label jackets and jeans and the latest trends in eyewear and footwear and all this stuff because it looks so appealing, it's so attractive, when you do those things, you are saying to the world, see, I'm just like you. I want to be just like you. I want you to think that I look pretty good. And you're not on the narrow way. So our King calls us out. He consecrates us for a special mission. He says, come follow me. Psalm 4 says, I know that the Lord has set apart him that is godly for himself. But to give you an example, the U.S. Marine Corps is the most hyper-disciplined group of soldiers in the Army. You know, they're chosen as a very for very difficult work, and they put them through boot camp, and they make them crawl through the freezing mud and under barbed wire and under a hail of bullets and go without sleep and go without food and spend nights in the cold ocean water trying to stay alive and all kinds of terrible things in hot temperatures. You know, you just really get put through the grinders if you want to try to be a Marine. And how do you think they go and recruit young men to join the Marines? You think they say, hey, anyone can be a Marine. Sign up now. It's easier than ever. You don't have to leave your job. You can study at night and do it from your recliner. You can set your own hours. It's totally free. No. You know what the slogan is of the Marines? The few, the proud, the Marines. Now, how much of popular Christianity tries to evangelize just like that. Come on in. It's easy. Be yourself. Do your own thing. We affirm the diversity. These are the slogans we hear. We can't ask people to do hard things in our churches. The time has passed for practical self-denial because that's not... You need to let people listen to their hearts and follow the spirit of their own thinking more because that's how it is. And so you can't ask them to follow brotherhood guidelines. That's not sincere obedience. It's a bullying tactic, we hear people say. You can't ask people to do hard things. Oh, really? The way of the kingdom is only for people who can do some hard things. That's how it is. And so we follow Jesus, who did the hardest thing of all for us, because he came to the earth and let himself get nailed to a post to save your and my life when we were pretty disgusting and unlovely. And so when I understand that I have been redeemed and called out to follow a Savior like that, then the definition of a hard thing for Jesus really scopes down to a very different place. And it's not that I view separation anymore as stuff I'm not allowed to do, which is unfortunately the way we usually think of it, right? Admit it. Separation in the Mennonite context means stuff I'm not allowed to do. I didn't think about the overlap, Brother Rick, but I'm the definition about what we permit and so forth. I thought about that, so I'm looking forward to Wednesday night. But stuff I'm not allowed to do. What if we would turn that all around and say, if you think like you were a Marine, the different things that I do is my choice because I'm on a special mission. It's not about stuff I'm not allowed to do. It's about what I do because I follow the man who said, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Number three, the desires of our heart determine our allegiance. Colossians says it well. Set your affection, the loves in here, the things that make my heart go whoomp whoomp, you know, the things that I really get inspired about. He says, set your affection on things on the earth, not on things down here. And Jesus, well, let's read it. Turn back a page here, Matthew 6, 19. Matthew 6:19. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And it goes on, talking about not serving two masters, but for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. You know what allegiance means? Allegiance has to do with your loyalty to a king, a nation, a people. Your allegiance is to the thing you follow. And so separation from the world is impossible and unsustainable without a change of allegiance. There has to be a change of heart. And so my first loyalty is to my King Jesus and the values of his kingdom. And until it's there, I cannot manage to live a separate life. It's a result of a heart that's loyal to just one king at a time. Let's look at a story here, Mark 14. This is an interesting perspective. In Mark 14, and you know, Jesus was in the garden, but before he went to the garden, he's talking to the disciples about what's about to happen. Verse 27, Mark 14:27. And Jesus said unto them, all ye shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, I will smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered. But after that I am arisen, I will go before you into Galilee. But Peter said unto him, although all shall be offended, yet will not I. And Jesus said unto him, verily I say unto you, that this day, even this night, before the cock crows twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. And now let's jump ahead. They go to the Garden of Eden, the Garden of Gethsemane, and verse 37, there Jesus is praying, the disciples fall asleep. And 37, he comes and finds them sleeping and saith unto Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? couldst not thou watch 1 hour? So Peter, you just said, nothing's going to turn you away. Here you are sleeping in this hour. And then look at verse, just jump on down to verse 53. They led Jesus away to the high priest. This was after the capture. And with him were assembled all the chief priests and the elders and scribes. And Peter followed him afar off, even into the palace of the high priest. And he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. And the story is not told here. Well, you can jump ahead to 66 in this chapter. As Peter was beneath in the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, "And thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth." But he denied, saying, "I know not, neither understand I what thou sayest." And he went out into the porch, and the cock crew. And the maid saw him again and began to say, "This is one of them." And he denied it again. And a little after, they that stood by said, "Surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto." And he began to curse and to swear, saying, "I know not this man of whom ye speak." And the second time the cock crew, and Peter called to mind the words that Jesus said unto him. And he went out and wept. And the point of this story here that I want to bring into separation is that like Peter, it is so easy for us as people who know that we ought to be separated to deny our connection with King Jesus, to sit by the fire, to try to pretend that we can go in there and warm ourselves with the other people, and hopefully nobody will notice. And so we camouflage our identity. We try to not be seen. And when the pressure comes on us, we're even willing to curse and swear a little bit to make sure they know that I'm not one of those people. And you know, it's just so easy. We can what's camouflage, you hunters? What's camouflage? Camouflage is what you put on yourself so that you're unnoticed from your surroundings. Right? You put things on yourself so that the animals don't see you when you're a hunter. It makes you less noticeable. And if I tell the world, if I use the world's slang and I laugh at the world's off-color jokes and I hang out at their rodeos and fairs and shows and entertainments and enter into all of the things that the world does to have fun, I'm essentially trying to swear a little bit like Peter and saying, "Nope, don't know the man. I'm just like you are. I'm just like you are." And it's a matter of love in here. Jesus says it so, or John says it so plainly. Don't love the world or the things that are in the world. Don't love the things that are in the world. If you love the world, the love of the Father cannot be in you. They can't be that way. We can't love two masters. I'm either going to love the world's culture and what they want to wear and what they think is fun, or I'm going to love what King Jesus says the kingdom is about. And it's just amazingly easy to stand by the fire and be willing to be just a little bit untruthful and hope nobody thinks I'm one of those people. Number four, we're no match for the devil's marketing. So think about this maybe longer ago, but maybe not. Maybe it still would work this way today. But how does the farmer catch the fat goose for the Thanksgiving table? Children, does he grab his axe and go out and holler around in the goose yard and wave and brandish his weapon and scare up all the birds and chase one down all around the place until he grabs it by the neck and gets a hold of one? No, that's not how a farmer catches a goose. He leaves his axe in the corner somewhere, right? And he gets a little bucket of grain and he dribbles it in front of the animals and coaxes them into the pen somewhere. The goose doesn't wonder. I wonder why he's giving me a little bit of food. Is something dark up? No, the goose is just happy that there's corn dribbling out, and they follow foolishly to their captivity, and much too late, they find their necks stretched between the two nails. And so that's how you get caught. And so our weak desires make the poisonous bait look like innocent nourishment. C.S. Lewis was famous for saying, he says, that we don't fall into sins because our desire for sin is so strong. He said, we fall into sin because our desires are too weak. We can't desire the good things enough. And turn, please, to Psalm 73. Here, David has some good words about this. It says here, he was looking at the, verse 2, my feet were almost gone, my steps had slipped, for I was envious at the foolish. I saw the prosperity of the wicked, for there are no bands in their death, their strength is firm, they are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men, and so on. They're corrupt, they have plenty to eat, and he just can't figure this out. He's so upset about this, until he gets to, let's see this, 17. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, and then understood I their end. Surely thou didst set them in slippery places, and cast them down to destruction. And you know, we tend to be attracted to the delicious things that the devil can dribble in front of us. And we can be amazed and delighted by the little entertainments that seem so attractive and innocent. And the prodigal son, you know, he said, Dad, I want to go have fun. I want to go. Give me the money. I want to go. And all he could see was the good times. And he could not for anything see down the road far enough to see himself in a pig pen starving and diseased and hungry and friendless. He couldn't see that. Any more than the goose can see the chopping block. That's how the devil operates. And we think we're a match for the devil's marketing sometimes. We think that we can go places and do things and watch things on our phones and so forth, and we'll know where to stop. It's not true. It's not true. Again and again, the prodigal son story has to be repeated and repeated because we don't see far enough down the road to see what the devil is offering us until we're like, the man who was, he had all the good things in his life, Jesus said, and there he was begging. Lazarus says, oh, just give me just one drop of water. And that's how it is. The father of lies wants us to think of separation as denying ourselves legitimate things for some future good. I'll say that again. The devil wants us to think that separation is when we deny ourselves legitimate things for some future good. Now, I'll give you an example. So in 1972, Stanford University did an experiment that became quite famous. They took a bunch of children and they brought them into, little children, brought them into this room one at a time, and on the table was this nice, big, attractive-looking marshmallow. And the researcher would tell the child, now, I'm going to go out of the room for 15 minutes and now don't eat the marshmallow. But if you don't eat the marshmallow until I come back, when I come back, you can have more marshmallows. But if you eat the marshmallow, when I come back, you won't get any more marshmallows. And what they were trying to do is to see how a child processes the concept of delayed gratification. Do I get this now, or do I wait a little bit and say no so that later I get a big pile? And so they put lots of children through this test, and then they followed the life of these children later as they went through school and got their first jobs and so forth. And their conclusion was, surprise, surprise, that children who could delay the gratification for the marshmallow also did better in school and did better in their jobs and did better financially and had more successful families and so on all the way through. But I actually think that when we cast separation that way for our youth, that is not enough. That is to say, I cannot tell my teenage children, look, I don't want you to taste these things of the world, because if you just wait, if you say no to these things, that would be okay, the marshmallow would be all right, but if you just wait, your payout is going to be a lot bigger in heaven. You know, your eternal reward is going to be the great payout here if you just wait a little bit. What's false about that teaching? What's false about that teaching is that we inadvertently give the message that the fun things of the world would be okay, but we're gonna not do them so that we win bigger in the end. And that's false. Jesus taught that's false. What's false about that is that the fun things in the world lead you to the chopping block. They're not legitimate. They're the things that are poison. They just look fun. And so cashing out on the big payout, that doesn't work. We have to take the opportunity in ourselves and for our youth to say, look, the things that you think are fun, the things that look fun out there, you just need to look down the road and see yourself in the pig pen some years from now. That's how you understand. It's not about a big payout in the end. You need to go down the road and see the broken down men and women who are in and out of the county jail and have lost their teeth and their beauty and their innocence and their freedom because they were enjoying themselves. And then you might hear people say, oh, but are you saying that if we lose our separation, our plain dress, we're going to wind up in the county jail? No. No. I would rather cast it this way. I think even children can understand this. I think what Jesus taught here about the narrow way and the broad way is something like this, that you're born into a world and there are two paths available in front of you, two options, two destinies. One of them is like a giant and very exciting and super slick sliding board that's quite a ride. And it's fun. Almost everybody is on it. They're all going down the ski slope, and it's really fun. They're having a good time. And out at the end, it dumps you out into this great precipice, and you go falling for a long time, and then end up in a burning lake of fire where you burn forever and you don't get the relief of dying. That's the end of that sliding board. But it's really a lot of fun while you're sliding. The other option is to go up this narrow stairs that goes up and up and up and up and up and takes a lot of energy, and it's kind of hard going. And if you keep going forever and ever, you eventually reach a city where it's joy and light and music and color and beauty for the rest of eternity. That's the end of that route. Now, if that's how you thought of your two options in life, and I want to say that between the stairs and the slide, there are cross paths. You can always get off the stairs, get on the slide. You can always stop yourself somewhere on the slide. God is merciful, and you can get back on the stairs. But if those are the options, and you think about that, would I say, you know, I think I'll try the slide just for a little while, the first couple turns, and I'll get off down there, maybe. You would do that only if you could not see the end of the slide. That's the only way you'd get on there. And so, what was my question? Do we think that if we don't be separated in our dress and our behavior and everything, that we're just going to end up in the county jail and as criminals and in hell eventually? Well, I don't think that we should say it that way. We should say it that there are two options. There are two paths. Only two. And sometimes people say, oh, you're teaching a works religion now. You're saying that somehow separation is going to get us to heaven. What about the heart? Yes. My faith in the mercy of Jesus helps me to separate myself from the idolatry of the world. And without separation, I will not enter the door. Jesus says in Revelations, blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life. Because guess what? Where's everybody else? Outside. Outside are sorcerers and whoremongers and murderers and idolaters and whoever loves and makes a lie. And so that's all the people on the broad way. And so cleansing our lives from worldliness is always mockable. That is to say, purging little bits of worldliness out of our lives, it's always mockable. There's always going to be someone who can say, oh, come on, that's a little radical, or that's not really the real issue. And we face a lot of pressure today from some of our evangelical friends in mainstream Christianity that tries to make a false dichotomy somehow that says that, well, either you are evangelizing and calling the lost, or you're focusing on keeping your own skirts clean, that you somehow can't do both. You can't attend to the spiritual growth and maturity of our own families and our keeping our churches disciplined places and places free of worldliness, because then if we're doing that, then we can't evangelize. And that's just not true. We're always called to do both things. We have some people on the other side who say that, well, what matters is separation, and that look at all the people who evangelize and how they lose their way. Well, that's not true either. We're called to do both. But we can be intimidated away from self-discipline when we listen to that argument too long. If it were true, as we hear sometimes, that separation and regulated church guidelines and so forth is somehow an immaturity, or it keeps us from being evangelistic and so forth. If that were true, then the churches all around us who don't make an effort at separation, but they're big on evangelism, they would just naturally have the highest rates of faithful children and intact marriages and self-denying lifestyles and doctrinal stability in the teachings of the scriptures, and these unseparated but mission-minded churches would naturally have the lowest rates of divorce and marriage trouble and scandal and substance abuse and power struggles in their leadership and so forth. And it's not the way it is. The devil works anywhere he wants to. And so we need to look down the road and listen to Jesus, who said, if you can't bear your cross, you can't be my disciple. And so if I think a little blending in, a little less distinction, a little more enjoyment of the good things won't matter, then I'm not understanding Psalm 73, and I'm not understanding the way of a cross. Well, we need to wrap this up. What does the narrow door mean in our day? When John said, don't love the things in this world, which world? Well, I guess Missouri. What does it mean in our day? A couple of things I'll just mention. That if we're going to have transformed lives, like Paul said, not conformed, but transformed, we need to renounce the idolatry of possessions and wealth, because we have to admit that's a source of where we lose our separation, is in idolatry of stuff. The man in the gospel, in the story that Jesus told, he said, I've got a lot of stuff. I'm going to build a bigger barn and take it easy. I'm well fixed. Well, don't love the stuff of this world, John says, because it's going to pay you well. It's going to be good for a while, but it's idolatry in the heart. How hardly, Jesus said, shall they that have riches enter into the kingdom. So separation starts with eschewing the idolatry of stuff. And I don't know what to do about these things. I think I've shared some of this before. By statistics, we here generally, as our mode of life, we're the richest 10% in the world. 90% of our fellow human beings do with less than we do. And so we have to think about that. I don't know. God has to work in our lives individually. You know, we say, well, we didn't do anything special. We're just here. We ate steak, and we stretch out on our leather lazy boys and have expensive mattresses to snore on, and we have leather heated seats in our vehicles and luxurious whirlpool tubs, and to the eyes of the rest of the world, we live like kings here in America. And I think that we have to just simply put some of these things before God and say, God, show me if I am being idolatrous in the way I live and buy stuff and enjoy myself. We have to do that. Keep some distance in our associations with unbelievers, I think, is another practical thing. Who do I spend my social time with? What about my vocational and professional endeavors? Am I closely associated with people who don't believe what we do, who don't believe that Jesus is the Lord of their life? And this can sometimes, in our age today, be very virtual. You know, who are the podcasters and the comedians and the shows and the news anchors and the people I'm listening to and enjoying virtually through our devices? That's a kind of association that's not a separation. We need to respect the wisdom of our brotherhoods on simplicity of appearance. And I know it's another subject. It's not really the subject of this message this morning. But the fashion industry is a multi-trillion dollar business, and it has been for a long time. And all I want to say is that sisters and brothers, there are plenty of people out there to tell you how to dress. not the church. There's plenty of influences out there that tell you that this is the way to dress. And those voices are much, much louder than the voice of brotherhood guidelines, have always been much louder. And it just presses in on us. And we can let it overwhelm us if we lose sight of the true kingdom dimensions of whose side we're on. You know, I'll just get practical. The fashion industry has long told our women that they should wear high heels to enhance their sensual appeal for men. So why in the world would a Christian woman put a veiling on her head to say that I'm a daughter of the king and then go mincing around in high heels or paint her face or do all the things that the ungodly men and women say, this is how you're attractive, hang jewelry on your ears and be something, be noticed. It just doesn't work. God created your beauty the way he did for his glory. And we can't let the ungodly tell you how to be more attractive. It's just true. This is just one area. There's so many ways in which the world says, do this, spend this money, and you will have more fun. People will notice you. And so, you put the little rows of blue lights on your trucks or aftermarket things, and I have no idea what earthly reason you would do that. Is that for the principles of Jesus? Is that for the kingdom somehow to add a lot of extra doodads on your vehicles, young men? Is it? Does that help you somehow think about what Jesus came here on the earth to do? And would you do it if nobody else ever saw it? Would you put it on your truck and park it in a shop never to be seen again? Probably not. That's not why people do that. We think it looks neat. And the pressure is just there, what I'm saying. The pressure is there for lots of people. Amazon is always there saying that, just click here, the little brown box will come and you will be happier with this new gadget in your life. And it's so much of a pressure to be like them, to do their things, to be fun, to have, to be admired. And it's the pride of life, John says. It's the pride of life. It's geared toward getting attention, and it's the very opposite of what Jesus said, come follow me, I'll teach you about a life of getting attention. It's very different than what you think it is, but the rewards are eternal. Well, we sing sometimes, who is on the Lord's side? Who is on the Lord's side, Joshua asked the people. And they said, we are. I will honestly say that I see no particular change in my lifetime in that groups who have decided to lead a plain life. Sometimes people say it's really getting bad. People are really falling away from what they've been taught. And I would say, no, study your American Mennonite history or any other course of history. And this has always been true. But it still can be very personal. It can be very personal, as you raised your hands at the beginning of the sermon, that we know people and we feel the pressure in our own families to just give in. I mean, do I really believe anymore in plain dress? Do I really believe in being separated from entertainment and the way the world does? Do I really believe in that stuff? The song, I Must Needs Go Home by the Way of the Cross Leads Home, it says, where is it? There's no other way but this. Yeah, there's no other way but this. And the truth is that there are plenty of other ways. We are told there are plenty of other ways. Plenty of people happy to tell us that true Christian fulfillment can only be had as you let go of a way of separation. That message has been with us a long time. And so I would just say, you think about it in your own family, in your own, the way you dress, the way you stand out. Young men, don't put all the burden of separation on the ladies here, by the way. They have to go in public and wear a head veiling, and people go in the airport, well, what's that? Are they Muslims? Are they Catholics? Or what are those weird people? Are you men as noticeable as your wife is in how you dress? Think about that. Maybe when you're at work or wherever. It's not. It is, please, brothers and sisters, this is not about somehow conforming, that the main thing here is that we have to conform to a church guideline. Those are things that we have to help us, but the main thing is, it's in here. It is right in here. Whose side am I on, and who do I want to be mistaken for or taken for when I go around and be seen? It's our choice, and we all have destinies. So if I find my heart is leaning too much toward fitting in, then I need to reconnect with Jesus, who hung on the cross so that you could be delivered from a place of darkness to a place of light, not so that you could ride the sliding board. Let's pray.
Merciful God, thank you for the great provision of salvation that you've made available for the whole world and each of us personally. I pray, Lord, today that we would be drinking deep at the fountains of your love and mercy and the scriptures, and not be so blinded by the good things the world has to offer. Help us, Lord, to be willing to be different. Be willing to follow you. Be willing be counted as one of your sheep. I pray for the families and the people present here, for your blessing on each home. We make choices from day to day. We would cast off the idolatry of things, the idolatry of possessions, cast off the attraction to the things the world has to offer us. Give us strength to walk in the way of truth, to walk toward our eternal destiny. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Yeah.